Okay, so I want to report on some recent work on using, trying to push, in fact, analytical results down to having less than one orbit to integrate numerically. And so the philosophy here is different from the one that Kip presented yesterday, where which was based, I think, on the philosophy that you, because post-Newtonian analytical type methods are badly convergent, you cannot rely on them much before you reach the last stable orbit, and therefore you have to think of something numerical 10 or 20 orbits before that. The philosophy here is different, and I've been confirming my opinion that in view of all the numerical problems, I don't see for the near future that people can compute 20 orbits. But many tools are ready, so although there are many problems left, maybe less than one orbit can be computed, and this is important for observation. So the, most of the work I'm going to talk about has been recently put on the net. It is based on earlier things which have been published in the last 2 years. So first, a reminder for non-experts, for people who don't know these things. Okay, this is the case of a small mass in around a big mass, and the geometry and the gravitational field of big mass is described as a Schwarzschild black hole. It's a non-rotating mass. So just to remind you that the important things, when you look at circular orbits, there exist circular orbits for large orbital radii, but then they cease to exist at a radius of 6m in units where Newton's constant is 1, and this is called the last stable circular orbit, or the innermost stable circular orbit. So for material, massive particles, this is the last circular orbit in which they can be. If you look at massless things, massless waves like light, they can be stored, there exist after that circular orbits, but which are unstable, and the last unstable circular orbit is also the, an unstable circular orbit where light can be stored around the black hole, and this is at 3m, and that will play a role at the end. And then you have the horizon at 2m. All these features in the test mass case can be easily derived by because you know the Schwarzschild metric, so you have an effective potential for circular orbits which depends on the angular momentum, and you have a picture like that where stable orbits are at the minima of this effective potential, unstable orbits are at the maxima, and the last unstable, which is this, is here. And then the last unstable circular orbit, which is the light ring, I will call it the light ring, this thing, is important because studies based on the on wave equations in this space-time have shown long ago that waves here are filtered out by a potential barrier, which means that anything which is emitted after you cross the 3m, essentially you don't see really what is emitted, but something heavily filtered out, and you see just characteristics of a black hole, which depends on the mass. And I will use that at the end in a heuristic manner. So it's just a reminder. This is for the case where you know everything, a small particle around a big mass. Now, it's not what we want to deal with. We want to deal with two black holes of comparable masses. And in fact, by the way, there is an argument we put in several of the papers. Most of the things that I will discuss, they depend on the symmetric mass ratio. So the notation is that the sum of the two masses is capital M, the reduced mass is mu, and the ratio of the reduced mass to the total mass, which is a dimensionless mass ratio, so which is symmetric in the two masses, is called mu. This quantity varies between 0 and 1/4. 0 is when one mass is very small compared to the other one. 1/4 is when the two masses are equal. Now, the fact that this is a maximum of a function means that when you have random values of the two masses, many an accumulation point will be at the maximum. And because this is a maximum, there are many values where you get this value or near this value. And for instance, even when the mass ratio is as different as 3, you get that this quantity is very near its maximum. And therefore, if there is one parameter which in the most important calculations to do can be fixed to 1/4, this is this one. I mean, so the equal mass case is not just a very specific case. The equal mass case is representative of a large class of systems where the mass ratio is of order unity, you know, between 1 and 3. And this is what you expect, because two black holes will have masses between 5 and 15, and therefore their mass ratio will always be of order that, and therefore for most cases what is important is in fact the maximum value of nu. Just that's a side thing, okay? But the only thing we know for sure is nu equals 0. And now we need a way to get information from 0 to 1/4. Now, nothing is known for sure, but what you expect is an analog of what happens in the test mass, which is to say, if I look now at the relative orbits, I mean, it's difficult to draw a diagram with two objects going around in two spirals like that, but what you expect is that, although it's not really proven, there will be a long moment where they go on a quasi-stable circular orbit, and they will move because of radiation reaction downwards. They will lose energy angular momentum. The radiation damping force will force them to come down. So this is the adiabatic in-spiral motion. Then you expect there should exist something that will last stable orbit, but the big question is, where is it located? We don't know, a priori, and I will give methods on how to determine where is the last stable orbit for comparable mass objects. But somewhere, hopefully around 6M or something of this order, there should be a last stable orbit. And then you expect that radiation reaction pushes you through the last stable orbit, and then you have some kind of plunge, where today, apart from the work I will present, nothing is known, but we claim that we know, in fact, already the main features of the plunge, and then you expect the two holes to merge, and you have the signal coming from the merger. So I want to describe, the philosophy here is that we propose that any analytical method, after suitable resummation techniques, can be pushed down to the level where you go through the last stable orbit and you have the transition to the plunge. And if you want to be on the safe side, this is where you stop from analytical method, because beyond that, all the resummation methods probably get worse and worse. So this is the, I would trust this down there. But we also push heuristically our method beyond that, down where we reach something like 3M, like the light ring, although now the accuracy gets bad, like probably 30% errors in the thing. But as there is nothing to compete with, it's important just to think about the signal to go down there. Okay.
So you're talking about this parameter nu being here 1/4 is quite a good thing. I just want to understand. So what is the accuracy when it's aiming at? 5%, 10%?
What is the accuracy on what?
That one is aiming at. I mean, for example, if in fact one of the masses of twice as big as the other one, then you're making about a 6% error. And so in your general philosophy here, 6% is negligible, right? I just want to
What is important is to get accuracy on the phasing. Here I'm not discussing accuracy on the parameters you will measure later. There will be a system with two masses, I don't know, there will be a mass ratio of 2 or 1.5. That will be given, the new value will be there, and when this parameter varies, you will have a set of templates, possible waveforms, and you want to capture the phasing of these waveforms as well as you can. Then there is a further question that we also investigate, which is, this being said, and what given the signal-to-noise ratio, with how you will reconstruct the parameters of the system. That's not what I want to discuss now. So let's say it's a mathematical parameter, given no.
These errors are tremendous. Then do I know from that the errors do not dramatically add up? So that if you say you have an error of 5%, so this means after the first orbit, your position is wrong by, let's say, 5%.
We
know from that after 5 orbits, the thing does not completely run out of any control.
This is a whole question by itself, which has been studied. For instance, there are, you might think that during the whole bandwidth of LIGO or Virgo, there are hundreds or more cycles that you have to, follow. In fact, this is not true, because you are more sensitive somewhere. So finally, you are sensitive to 5 to 10 cycles somewhere. So what is very important is that for these cycles, the way their frequency changes at the moment where they are caught like that is well reproduced. And even if you miss the phasing somewhere. So the fact that, because you seem to worry about errors accumulating, if you have a good parametrization in the mathematical space of the mathematical form of these things, you do not worry about this thing. Okay, for instance, post-Newtonian approximations, they always have an error at some point, but Okay, it is controlled by, you do that by adding other terms from the next post-Newtonian approximation and testing the robustness of the conclusions. And what you get at the end is that it's not that you miss completely the signal, it's that you estimate a little bit wrongly with bias the parameters. But you can deal with that. Okay, but that's an old, a whole industry, so I don't want to discuss it. Now, physically, I want to emphasize something. This is a curve which I found important that we understood recently, although it was implicitly understood, not in this form. Okay, what is this curve? This curve represents the signal-to-noise ratio that will be observed from if you observe the coalescence of two black holes, here taken because of the argument I just said with the same mass. What is plotted here horizontally is the total mass of the binary system, so it's the sum of the two masses, or in this approximation, in fact, in this assumption, this is twice the mass of one hole. So, for instance, if you have two black holes of 10 solar masses, you will be here, and if you have two of 15 solar masses, you will be there. Okay. Now, what is plotted vertically is the signal-to-noise ratio in one detector. So it tells you how much above the one sigma noise you are. And this level, which is a threshold of 5, is the kind of threshold you will be able to say you detect something. Below this threshold, you see nothing, because there are too many false alarms and things like that. Okay. So, but below, here it's 4.5. Okay. So, so I don't want to say here that Virgo has an advantage, although Virgo has an advantage over LIGO, because Virgo goes to a signal-to-noise ratio beyond 6, and LIGO does not. But this is for a source which is at 100 megaparsecs, and you can hope that every 2 years there is a binary black hole coalescence if the recent numbers from Posnov, Prohorov, and then what we heard from Keith yesterday are more or less correct. Then one can hope in 2 years to have really an event within 100 megaparsecs, and then give a signal like that. Now, what is the mass of black holes, of galactic black holes that we expect? Maybe it's between 5 and 15 solar masses, maybe a little bit more, in which case you are interested in this range here, okay? From 10 to 30, something like that. And now, in this range, in fact, Virgo has just a slight advantage on LIGO, because it gets higher signal-to-noise ratio for much more massive black holes, and nobody knows if they exist or not. So from this point of view, this thing should not be trusted to that. But what is important here for LIGO is that the maximum of the signal-to-noise ratio barely makes it to the threshold, and therefore, the first detections you expect in the coming years, the 2-3 years, if one is lucky, really comes from here. Because it cannot come from here. It cannot be neutron stars, it cannot be low-mass black holes, it has to be there. And therefore, the source one has, the most important source, is something where you have the maximum of this curve, which is around 28 solar mass for the two black holes. And what this curve illustrates also is that there is a dotted line. This dotted line means that if you misrepresent a little bit your signal analytically, then you lose critically signal to noise. And therefore, it is very delicate. You need to know the waveform and the motion of the black holes very accurately from this. And where do you need to know? That's now the main point I want to make. This is a blow-up of the previous thing, is that the maximum of this signal-to-noise ratio is obtained, this curve here is the LIGO sensitivity curve. Okay. The sensitivity curve is here defined as the inverse of the broadband noise curve. That is to say, if you, with LIGO, you try to detect a signal where you only know that the frequency variation of the signal is of the order of its frequency, so it's a broadband signal. And finally, what we discuss, it's essentially this. Then you see that the maximum of this sensitivity, which is the inverse of this noise, is exactly nearly at the maximum of this thing. And this means what? This means that the signal which you get from this heavy binary black hole, it is obtained, in fact, finally, because there is another information here, is the frequency at the last stable orbit. What is plotted here is the frequency at the last stable orbit. And finally, the conclusion of all that is that the signal you will get is obtained by seeing the last three orbits before reaching the last stable orbit and during the transition. This is where the signal if one can hope to detect something in 2 to 3 years, this would be only these massive systems. And these systems, the most important signal that you see is not in the in-spiral phase long before, but just at the end for the last 3 orbits, before the last stable orbit and during the transition. And therefore, it is very urgent in the coming years to be able to model very precisely this transition from the in-spiral to the plunge, when it occurs, at what frequency, and how the plunge begins. And this is what I'm dealing with. Sorry, what? Yes, this is plotted with our analytical estimates. And now I'm going to say, within what we do, we have a specific set of predictions for everything. Not only where is the last stable orbit, but how you go through it, and what is the signal through it. And now this is what I did. The problem, okay. So what I'm going to say is, in my opinion, the best things analytical methods can now do, but there is no external way of proving that I'm right. The only way would be to have a large canonical simulation starting much before, okay? So I cannot prove mathematically what I'm saying is correct. But I will try to show internally the robustness of the method by as many internal consistency checks, okay? But this is still not a proof. Okay, so first, another reminder. Okay, why people usually say, okay, post-Newtonian calculations are useful, but they lose their validity precisely in the regime where I just said, which is the most important, near the last stable orbit, which is where the first signals will be detected, okay? By the way, what I said applies to LIGO 1, okay? LIGO 2 has a much better signal-to-noise ratio, and therefore the problem is different, okay? But we are talking about the next 3-4 years. Okay, so you all know that post-Newtonian calculations give you a formal expansion of the metric of a type like that, and they give you also at the same time a formal expansion of the equations of motion, by which I mean the motion of each body as attracted by the mass of the other one. So you have equation of this type where you have the Newton law, and then, okay, so I will not read the whole history of this thing. Somebody has noticed what meant this, I guess. Now, there are two parts of the equations of motion doing analytical calculations. Because, okay, roughly you can distinguish, these are V square over C square and higher order corrections to Newton's law, okay? And you can distinguish here things which are even powers of 1 over C and odd powers of 1 over C. In fact, this distinction becomes wrong at, now I forgot, V8 over C7. We have computed the first effect, which is the tail effect, which is an effect, which is an integral over the full path, and where there are logs occurring, and therefore there is something goes wrong in what I'm saying. But this is beyond what we are going to discuss now. So formally, you can separate the equations of motion in a path which is symmetric under time reversal, and this part will derive from, will have conserved energy, momentum, everything, and therefore we'll derive from an Hamiltonian, and we'll have all the Poincaré invariants. This is, let's call it, the conservative part of the dynamics. Okay, I'm already using perturbation theory to make this distinction, because there is nothing sharp in this distinction. But then, on top of this conservative part of the dynamics, there are those terms which are odd, and which gives you radiation reaction. Okay. Now, when you compute these terms at this level, it's very difficult to go very far, so they are computed, in fact, in another way, by assuming balance of energy and angular momentum between what is lost in the mechanical system of bodies and what goes in waves at infinity. And this allows to compute the odd part, the radiation, gravitational radiation reaction, to an accuracy which is a fractional accuracy extremely high. For instance, the V5 over C5 in this term, which is V5 over C5, so it's V10 over C10, is computed in this heuristic way, and that would be a term much beyond this part. Okay, but I don't want to show you explicit results there. I want to mention why people usually think that one cannot use post-Newtonian expansions, even at the last stable orbit, although the last stable orbit is like 1/6, I mean, it's 6 GM, so you could hope there is a smallish parameter, 1/6, or maybe 1/3, 1/3, because the horizon is at 2. Is there a smallish parameter like that? Yes, but it all depends on the way you use those expansions. These expansions have a radius of convergence, which is such that if you write them in various forms, it can look very badly convergent, or you can resum them. And what I will explain is ways of resumming these expansions so that you can really trust what they give numerically at the last stable orbit. If you do nothing...
Do you know if these expressions converge at all?
Yes, okay.
word.
Yeah, I should not. Still, you can resum them.
Free word.
But make predictions which are useful for physics. Okay, now if you do nothing, what would be, for instance, in a specific coordinate system which is often used, the predictions for the gravitational wave flux computed like that by successive perturbation theory at the last stable orbit, so this is the point where you would be interested, then you find a zeroth term which would be the quadruple formula, and then the first correction to this would be -174%, and then the next term would be +112%, so okay. So you have this series first, okay? And this means this is nonsense to try to use that, okay? So we cannot use perturbation theory. Also, if you try to estimate for the comparable mass system what is the frequency, gravitational wave frequency, at the last stable orbit, for instance, and if you use the energy expression and you say it has to be a minimum of the energy potential, then you get at the first post-Newtonian approximation that the for 40 solar mass system that you get a prediction of 880 hertz instead of 110. So you get a factor 8 wrong. You get still a factor 2 wrong if you go to 2pn and things like that. So they look like complete nonsense. Now, several things have been proposed to improve the situation, okay? Kidder, Will, and Wiseman proposed a partial resummation where they try to separate what is known from the Schwarzschild case. And then take the rest as a perturbation expansion. This improves things a little bit, but in fact not much. One can show that there are many problems with this thing, and it's not a good resummation technique. So we are going now to discuss other things. So we will use two types of new resummation techniques which have been proposed in recent papers, and from these we will compute analytically where is the last stable orbit. We will compute nearly analytically, because this is integrating an ODE, the transition from the inspiral to the plunge, and give initial data for numerical relativity just at the beginning of the plunge, where there is 60% of an orbit to go, only 0.6 orbit to go, and we will also give a rough estimate of the waveform all the way down. Okay. Now, the physical assumptions in this work, apart from the mathematical ones that I will tell later, is that we are speaking about non-spinning holes. But this is probably the most important source to start with, okay? From all existing models, you do not expect to have high spins on these objects. And in fact, to make a difference, you would need like 0.99, you know, near extremality of the spin, okay? If you are anywhere below 0.5 or something like that, it would not change much what I'm going to say. But anyway, it's assumed the spins are zero here. And the other very important assumption is that we realize that what is assumed to make everything I'm going to say work is we are make an approximation where the motion remains quasi-circular. Evidently, this is true during the inspiral motion, but it is also true during the plunge. This was the surprise, because initially we thought that the plunge would be like they go like that, but in fact they continue going like that, even for a fraction in orbit, and this allows to push our method, which is based on this assumption, quite far. Now, the problem, we split the problem in two parts. One, which is to resum the part of the dynamics which does not contain radiation reaction, okay? And the other part, which is to resum the radiation the gravitational radiation reaction that you add onto the dynamics without gravitational radiation reaction. Now, so let me treat the first part, which is which uses a specific new thing. So now I'm neglecting gravitational radiation reaction, and I want to start from post-Newtonian expansions. I want to start from the knowledge in post-Newtonian expansions and resum it. By the way, I want to emphasize that all the resummation techniques I'm talking about, they never add terms. I mean, if you re-expand what is used at some post-Newtonian level, the coefficients contain just exactly the same information as in a post-Newtonian expansion. We did not add any information, any perturbative information, but we add non-perturbative information by saying we think a way of representing the results should not be a simple 1 plus x squared type of, you know, truncated Taylor series, but represent this in a different functional way, which probably whose expansion is the same as the other one, but which is valid much beyond the other one. Okay, so for the conservative dynamics, we use an ID which dates back to works in quantum electrodynamics in the 70s, In particular, the first, Brezin, Itzigson, and Zinn-Justin used, in fact, an infinite resummation of Riemann diagrams linked to the Iconal approximation, and they noticed something remarkable is when you resum this partial set of ladder and cross-ladder diagrams, you can represent the QED energy levels of two comparable mass charges, like could be a positronium state or simply high precision corrections to the electron to the hydrogen atom, okay? But they wanted to deal with the case where you have comparable masses, or at least where you cannot neglect the mass ratio. And so they showed that by resumming things, you could represent this two-body problem as an effective one-body problem, that is to say, a charge in an external electromagnetic field, okay? This was the idea, which was successful at a certain level. It has been then pushed by others, but we did not use the refinements that people try to make. In fact, they are not very useful. So, but we just start from the idea, and we say, okay, so let us map our two-body problem, the problem of two gravitationally interacting bodies, which means what? In perturbation theory, it means this is a space-time diagram. I have two masses evolving in space-time, and they exchange many gravitons. So I have the gravitational interaction, I take it at the linear level, non-linear level, gravity creates gravity which attracts the other one. You have to sum all these things. This gives a complicated post-Newtonian Hamiltonian for the interaction of the two bodies. That's the two-body part. On the other part, let's consider a fictitious problem, which is that I have one test particle, mass, moving in some external geometry, so following a geodesic motion in some space-time that I don't know. We don't assume this space-time is Schwarzschild. It's not going to be Schwarzschild. We are going to assume it is spherically symmetric because this matches all the thing in the problem. So, we have geodesic motion. So we have a certain action, a certain dynamics. And now we want to map these two dynamics, but we want to map it in completely invariant ways. Never use coordinate quantities now because coordinate quantities are a mess and they are responsible for the bad convergence properties of many of these quantities also. So one way of representing the basic idea is to work at the quantum level, although we do work only at the classical level, but the quantum language is useful. Is you can think of the bound states in the two problems, either two-body bound states or one body in an external potential, and the bound states, the energy levels will be, because this is a spherically symmetric, so that in this case, will depend on two quantum numbers. The energy levels will depend on the angular momentum quantum numbers and on the principal quantum numbers n, okay? Now, the same thing is true for one test mass moving in a spherically symmetric external gravitational field like that. And now, those quantum numbers, by definition in quantum mechanics, they are quantized in integers. And therefore, it is very natural to say that you are going to map the two by identifying the quantities which are integer valued, and which are therefore this and this. Now, when you go back to the classical problem, what are these quantities which are quantized in the WKB limit, let's say, of quantum mechanics? These are the adiabatic invariants, the integral of PdQ over cycles in the classical problem. And therefore, what we are saying here is we identify the adiabatic invariants in the two problems, but then we only require that there is a correspondence between the energy levels. But this correspondence, you can easily see that it cannot be an equality of the masses because there is not the same reference energy level. In the two-body problem, you have the M1 plus M2 as the rest mass, and you have only the test mass. I mean, there is something which does not evidently fit in identifying energy levels. So you leave it open. You say there may be one arbitrary function which maps this energy to this energy. Okay. And now you ask the question, you ask this problem. Can I find an external metric and a function f such that keeping the same adiabatic invariance, I have the map of this and this? And the answer is when you work at what is the best level which is fully known today, which is the so-called 2PN information, using the work we had done 15 years ago, and using in particular also the reformulation of that. Because this energy level business, at the classical level, is called the Delaunay-Hamiltonian. Delaunay-Hamiltonian is the energy expressed as a function of the adiabatic invariance. It's a nice coordinate invariance representation of the dynamics. So here, a first resummation is that we skeletonize the information of post-Newtonian expansions to invariants, which contains many less no gauge information, and we deal with that. And now we do this mapping of problem. Now, if we impose the natural requirements, because there is a free parameter, in fact, not only we can map the two problems, but we can map them in many ways, but there is something natural, which is to say the effective metric will at lowest order look like Schwarzschild. There will be somewhere 1 minus 2m over r and 1 plus 2m over r. Okay. So let's impose that, we can. And then when you do that, there is a unique function mapping the energy levels. And what is very nice is that this unique energy function is the one which had been used by Bresin, Dixon, and Zinn-Justin long ago, and we had used for another reason as the simplest function of Mandelstam invariance you could work with in two-body questions. Okay. So there is something nice and simple. Okay. You start from complicated post-Newtonian expansions, and the more you do this mapping, the more you get simple results. So for me, this is not a proof that this is correct, but at least it is nice to see that.
Can I just go back to the previous question?
Yes?
Where there's two problems and you want to map what is the data, right?
Yes.
So twice in passing you said, well, it's spherical symmetric. Now, on the right hand side, you can do whatever you want. I mean,
yes.
We're fine. So we can choose it to be spherical symmetric in order. Then, if I do something wrong.
But you know this.
Why is that? But why is the. So I'm looking at the post-Newtonian problem, right?
Mm-hmm.
That equal mass problem.
Yes.
And they're not particularly the closed limit on it.
No.
No,
they are separate.
Where does this spherical symmetry come from? Where does this come
from? Okay, at this level of this game, this is a problem we talk about. This is a non-spherically symmetric, each body does not see it. Okay, first, what happens is that, in a sense, the effective field that each body sees is in its own reference frame. Okay, and it's not the reference frame of the outside observer like you saying these things go around and I will have a total, like for instance, angular momentum in the system. No, when you are in the system, you are rotating with your companion and you see a very different thing. I'm not saying that the effective metric is, by the way, linked to any real metric. I'm just saying this is an effective description of its interaction. Now, what is the reason why we impose this is that this you can prove. When you have a two-body system like that, the energy levels are quantized. I mean, you can specify them in terms of very spherical symmetry. There is not the magnetic quantum number, M. So there is not like a spin coupling, because the spin coupling would have like a magnetic quantum number. There would be a specific direction in space. You have only N and J. And therefore, when you try to map it, you cannot here write, I mean, you can, but there are problems, okay? And it's not needed. Anyway, there may be other ways of doing that. I'm just saying why... at this level, there is no reason to go non-spherically symmetric because of this dependence on the two quantum numbers. These are characteristic of, spherically symmetric. The first thing in spherical symmetry is that you have a radial quantum number.
Let me try to say it in a different way. We've already decided that we've thrown out field theory. We're talking about interactions and partitions. From the interaction of these two particles, there is some rotation movement. That rotation there's clearly no third direction in the space except defined by the particle itself.
Which is one specific motion, yes.
Yeah,
but if you take the space of all motions,
right.
There is no special direction. That's the main thing, yeah.
It's not any direction except the direction from one particle to the other.
Because you see, if one was trying to say there is spin in the system...
From one particle to the other. So where does the space
of all motions...
In the set of all,
space of
all motions. No, not the translation. That's why there is an external field problem, and the external field defines an origin, but not angle, spatial angle. This is consistent, yes. The center of mass motion has been found. We are in the center of mass, okay. Yes? No. Ah, yes, no. There is, yes. Now, there is something. After the Bresin, Ethics, and Zinn-Justin work, people said, okay, can I now do that to all orders of perturbation theory? And the answer is you. That is to say, you start from scattering amplitudes, for instance, Feynman scattering amplitudes, and you map the whole set, now you identify the whole set of scattering amplitudes for two-body things in the center of mass, so you use kinematical variables where you have only like related things, to external problem for one particle, and you can do that order by order in the Feynman expansion. The problem is that when you do that to all orders, and you reinterpret this as an external potential. It has never been proven this can be like an external field of the type you want, and also that you have to inject like energy dependence of this effective thing, which we try to avoid here to avoid conceptual problems in when there is radiation reaction. We don't want the metric we talk about to depend on the motion we consider. We want the metric to be independent of all the motion, but to convey this information, the minimum information that this is a two-body problem. Yes, you go to the center of mass, and therefore you reduce kinematical variables to the p of only one particle, so you have p1 minus p2, okay? Yeah? And then you write this reduced, I mean, this is still the same amplitude p, and you say, I want to define an external potential in the Lippmann-Schwinger equation such that the Lippmann-Schwinger iteration gives me the same as the Feynman field theory amplitudes. And you can do that to all others, but not maybe in a useful way. quite a lot. This was to avoid many problems. The Bethe-Salpeter equation does not resemble the same type of diagrams, and there are many problems, and the effective external field is tuned to solving the problems of the Bethe-Salpeter equation. So I'm here using information of improvement on the Bethe-Salpeter equation. Yeah, now I forgot among the ladder, the cross ladder, and the ones that are not included. Okay, I have to check this thing. Yes. Okay. By the way, there is a disc. Isikson was an expert on that, and that's why in his book, because I learned that reading Isikson Zuber, you know, and there you have both a discussion of this, a very brief one. You have to be careful to notice it, and one somewhere else, 200 pages later, on the Bethe-Salpeter equation. Okay. We cannot ask Isikson anymore, but I discussed with Zuber about this thing, and with Zinjustin also. Anyway, there is nothing better now that can be done in this thing. But I'm not saying this is the ultimate. I'm being pragmatic here, you know. And when it works, when it does not violate my intuition, for instance, you had the question here, and this was a question we ask ourselves, but then we answered this way. So okay. But it would be good.
What is surprising to me was that the left hand side, which is a real result from both the Gordon method, that even when you include all higher effects, right, in some
even
higher order,
even
order, yeah, right. But
you
would
dissolve
the order,
then. No,
sorry, yeah, I left out the radiation here.
Yeah, you left
out. I'm not making the exact statement to answer James' question. Would give an horrifying external potential that we don't want to use. Here we are resting ourselves to geodesic motion in an external metric. Okay, and in fact, now we are finishing what happens at 3 p.m. And there are subtleties at 3 p.m., so I am not making statements. Okay.
Well,
the
final.
This is 2 p.m. Yes, no, certainly.
Oh, okay.
I answered something to all others, okay? But the answer is correct, but not in the same context.
So okay. This is
2 p.m. Okay. Now, what is the result? Okay. The result, apart from the energy map that I don't write explicitly, which is quite simple, is that this effective metric, okay? In the Schwarzschild gauge is therefore defined only by the G00 and the GRR coefficient, and you expect these, when u equals zero, they have to be Schwarzschild, okay? And what is nice is that there are deformations of Schwarzschild which are very simple to write, but what is more important than simple is that this coefficient here, so nu, remember, is goes from 0 to 1/4. Now, when the maximum deformation of, and this thing is the crucial part of the Schwarzschild effective interaction, because this is the potential energy. This is what would be the Newtonian 1 over R, which is modified by relativistic effect. So let's look this term at the last stable orbit, the former, the old one, where this was 1/6. You see that this term is 1/6 to the cube times 2 1/4 at maximum, and therefore the difference is only 2 10 minus 3. So finally, you have resummed your dynamics. The 2PN dynamics was very badly convergent. And at the LSO, if I was writing the 2PN Hamiltonian, at the LSO, the 1PN term was a large correction of the Newtonian term. The 2PN term was not a small correction of the thing. And I could not use this Hamiltonian. But now I have retranscribed let's take just this as a mathematical way of doing things. I am retranscribing the problem in a different set of variables. And in this set of variables, I find that the 2PN effects are 2 10 minus 3 correction of what I know at Schwarzschild, okay? even in the worst comparable mass. This is finally the only kind of proof of internal robustness of the system. Okay, you can forget all the rest. I'm saying this thing is a way of writing the same dynamics, the same information as 2PN, but in a form which is which I can trust now down to the LSO. Yes. If I re-expand them, yeah, the geodesic equation, if I re-expand them to 2PN, which is V4 over C4, beyond Newton, before radiation, just before radiation, is the same geodesic equation, the same expansion as the usual one, but written in a completely different way. And here is the Hamiltonian, maybe, that you want to look at. By modern standards, this is a very simple 1PN level. You have to look our papers to see the unbelievable 2PN thing, and the recent papers of Yaranovsky and Schaeffer for the 3PN things, which gets really bad. Yes. No, if you take, okay, that's a good point. If you take that Lagrangian, the one in Landau-Lifshitz, which is only 1PN, you get no correction term. Because there is something also remarkable that I did not say, which is part of why the resummation is so effective, is that this term, that's why I did not say it, this term is a 2PN correction. There could have been a 1PN correction to Schwarzschild, because if you do the Landau-Lifshitz, this is beyond Newton, you know, in the Newtonian approximation, this does not count. This is like Newton, and therefore the V square over C square things in Landau-Lifshitz would be the 1 over C4 here, but this is 1 over C6. And therefore you see, as I should have put like a plus zero times the square of it. It is part of this thing that you have no modification of this. So, like Schwarzschild gives you all the information in Landau-Lifshitz if you use the invariant methods we use, for instance. Okay. We don't know for sure.
But this, yes. This is also issue of, I mean, suppose you want somebody else to do the same idea, that wants to do the resummation.
Yes.
But use a slightly different function F.
No, the function f is fixed by the resummation.
By
okay. Yes, it's fixed to all orders. Because you have this, okay, I did not go to the mathematics, you have these very stringent requirements that you have, finally, you have the energy levels are a function of two variables. Okay, I said in the quantum level they are quantized, okay, but in what we do classically they are not quantized, they are two independent variables, and you specify two power series. Now, the energy levels as function of n and j is one power series. Then you have the other one you generate for an effective metric. And then imposing that these two power series are identical when you impose an arbitrary function f between the two fixes all the Taylor coefficients of everything in the metric and in the function f. You can look up our papers, that's thick. It's even, there is some freedom that we free that 1PN by saying this is where we have this freedom by saying that you get Schwarzschild at the linearized level. It looks natural and simplifies everything. Yes?
Then you have only from this front on very small contributions. Wouldn't that not also mean that you need a lot of terms to get the right deviation from Schwarzschild?
What do you mean, the right deviation from Schwarzschild?
You say that you think it's correct because
No, no, I did not say I think it is correct. I said this is consistent. It is it's consistent now to use this down to the last stable orbit because by accident it happens that the corrections are so small that within this method there is no signal within the method that, you know, we cannot do that. On the contrary, it's a very small effect. So we know it is correct in the nu equals zero limit. The nu equal 1/4 other extreme is a small deviation from this, so we trust it. It's not a proof that we can't really trust it.
I think Peter is saying that probably when you don't have, when you sum the whole series, that effect will not go up this, and it may.
It may. And I should say also that there are part of the things that we do not resum that I will say at the end, that, because we work only with invariant quantities here, and when you finally want to retranscribe this in some coordinate system, there is a part that we did not try to resum because we did not need it at this stage. Yes?
But you said earlier that, you know, the numeric design is going to change the unit, but I don't see, from what you said so far, form of blindness is restricted to particular orbits, why can't I just calculate the Schrödinger Hamiltonian, what's supposed to happen in a head-on collision, compared to the axisymmetric stuff and see whether it matches?
That's a good point. You are fully right. This part of the thing never assumes that we look at quasi-circular orbits, and in principle this is a resummation of the most elliptic things and also the ones that directly plunge into the black hole. So it's, your point is interesting to try to compare. Okay, the next part of the talk will be to go through the plunge and to add radiation reaction, and to be able to add radiation reaction today we need to assume quasi-circular. So for radiation reaction, we will be limited. But up to this point, you are fully right, we are not. Now, what finally it means is that the Hamiltonian giving the evolution in phase space for those variables that we use in the effective problem is given by this explicit expression. And this explicit expression is not a usual relativistic Hamiltonian. The relativistic Hamiltonian would be square root of p squared plus m squared with the g0 function here. So it would be just the internal square root thing. And this is what you get when u tends to zero, in fact. But here you get a second square root. And what I'm saying is that if you re-expand this Hamiltonian and change gauge in a post-Newtonian way, this reproduces all the perturbative things. But the fact that it has this structure, which is square root of square root, and inside all the 2PN corrections are contained only here at this level and in the B coefficient, which is the other one here, is a good sign that we can trust this dynamic. Now, at this level, we don't need, by the way, here we did not, finally, the resummation is done by this change of variables, change of Hamiltonian. We do not even try to resum the functions we get by Pabé approximants, because the function A is, this is such a small correction, you don't even want to Pabé it, you don't need it, the series is good as it is. We will use Pabé for other things. At 3PN, the situation might be different. So let me, internally, when we do this game, it's very difficult to prove that we are correct. But a way to prove convergence is to prove convergence like in mathematics, where you have the Cauchy criterion for convergence, which, when you don't know the limit, how do you prove convergence when you don't know the limit? You have something which is Cauchy convergence, which is saying that the differences essentially between the successive things get smaller and smaller. You don't say that's not the correct formulation. But when you have a finite order, what we can do is say, okay, let's look at this and let's consider what happens when I compute 1PN quantities and 2PN quantities, because I can do that in this game, you know. And what you get is that they are extremely near each other. So evidently, everything could go wrong at higher orders, you know, it could blow up. But the fact that before, when you computed 1PN and 2PN, just that, you started factor 8 above the real answer, then you went down to factor 2, and okay, convergence was very bad, okay? Here, you don't move nearly from 1PN to 2PN. So internally, this is some sign that maybe it is better, okay? I don't want to push it. But we believe it can be trusted. Now, from this, so we can deal with elliptic orbits, but also with circular orbits. So in particular, if we restrict now ourselves to circular orbits, we have an effective potential for circular orbits, which is exactly like the Schwarzschild one, except for this term. So, and now we can investigate what are all the quantities at the last stable orbit. I mean, first, this thing, within this scheme now, this proves the existence of a last stable orbit, because you get effective potentials which are just small deformations of the Schwarzschild case, and therefore you have a stable circular orbit here, stable circular orbit, and you have a inflection point here, and this defines within our scheme where is the last stable orbit, and it is a little bit inwards compared to the Schwarzschild case. And for instance, one test that this is stable is you can do that at the 1PN level, at the 2PN level, and you see the effects are small, and they seem to go somewhere, but after 1PN they move a little bit, okay? 3PN could be completely off, okay? But so we trust that anyway. The rest of the talk will use 2PN as if it were exact. And yes, so I should say that here I've worked only with the invariant part of the dynamics, because I use only gauge invariant quantities, but we are working in specific gauges. Post-Newtonian calculation use either harmonic coordinates, like in the original calculations, which have been now pushed to 3PN, or ADM coordinates, and by ADM I mean not 3 plus 1 splits, but the explicit gauge which was found useful because compatible with the canonical formalism of ADM, which is where you have a condition which fixes the last, which is that the ordinary flat space trace of the conjugate momentum is zero, and that you have something which fixes the shift, okay, the coordinate system in each license, because this was compatible. And they have post-Newtonian calculations that have used this gauge, so it is useful to work with these coordinates because we are near what exists in explicit calculations, and because they use an explicit 3+1 split, I hope that this is a good framework for, at the end, giving initial data for numerical relativity, but this is definitely not completed. And then you have a generating function. Finally, the effective coordinates that we use, they are related to the original ADM type by a canonical transformation in phase space, in a QP phase space, which is defined by a generating function which is explicitly given as a post-Newtonian series that we don't try to resum at this stage because we don't use it for most of this work. But everything is explicit to make the full contact with perturbation series. Because our method uses invariants, but we go back to non-invariant quantities. Okay, now it is crucial to complete this part of the dynamics, which gives only the existence of last stable orbit and the value of the frequency, gravitational wave frequency. So finally, the gravitational wave frequency at the last stable orbit for the comparable mass case is something like 15% higher, I'm quoting like that, than the Schwarzschild case computed from the total mass, let's say. So we have explicit formulas for that. Now let's add gravitational radiation reaction. So in general, if you were working either, for instance, you can say in a Lagrangian formalism, I would add something in the right-hand side. If I transcribe this in the Hamiltonian formalism, I need to add two things when I consider motion in the... Because of the symmetry that we use, we can work in the equatorial plane. So we just have two quantities to add, like a radial force here and a force in the phi, p phi equation of motion. Okay. Now we use what has been done is in Newtonian calculations of these quantities. First, to notice one thing is that one of the two quantities is not gauge invariant, in the sense that if you shift a little bit your coordinate system by terms which are odd, you can modify at will this quantity, first thing. Another thing, when you look at the effect of this quantity in the equations of motion, it contains small parameters. This quantity is proportional to r dot, to the radial velocity, and now we use the fact that we are a slow radial velocity compared to the circular velocity. So this term is both small and can be gauged away also. And therefore we use a fiducial gauge where we set it to zero, and at the end, we set it to 1 instead of 0, in the natural coefficient there, to check that our predictions do not change numerically. So this is the technique to check robustness, but it is not an important thing. Okay. Now, what is essential is the other one, because this quantity is what? It's the quantity which gives angular momentum loss, because finally this equation tells you for quasi-circular orbit, that, or for any orbit, that f phi gives the amount of rate of loss of angular momentum of the binary system due to radiation reaction locally, but which should be connected with flux at infinity. Now, in the quasi-circular case, you can average over an orbit, which is not true for an elliptic case. In the elliptic case, you would not be able now to write f phi because there is a phase dependence of f phi where along the elliptic orbit, f phi has this and this value, while the flux at infinity is average over an orbit, in fact, or it's not related time-wise together. But in our case, we assume now, so we assume, because this has been checked in where it could be checked, that there is energy and angular momentum balance between fluxes at infinity and what's in the mechanical system. And therefore, if we can resum the gravitational wave flux at infinity, then we can inject that. Now, this problem has been solved before by some work with Ayer and Satya Prakash, where the idea was the following. How can we know that the perturbation expansions, the post-Newtonian expansion of the gravitational wave flux, as a function of an invariant variable, so you express the gravitational wave flux as a function of the gravitational wave frequency. The gravitational wave frequency, okay, modulo 2 pi and things like that, and in dimensionless form, you introduce this quantity. This is a frequency, therefore it's an invariant. It's not a gauge-dependent concept. It's frequency as seen at infinity. So you have two quantities, which are dimensionless and invariant, energy flux and frequency at infinity. So the function linking the two is a gauge-invariant object. Now this function is not well convergent, is badly convergent, although it is better than the one I showed before. But we had shown that we can resum it by using Padé approximants by the following mathematical assumption. The assumption is the following. We inject the information we know. This function is a deformation, is a deformed version of the function which is known numerically and analytically to many post-Newtonian orders in the case nu equals zero. So we consider the mass ratio, nu, this parameter, as a deformation parameter. When this deformation parameter is zero, we know something about this function. For instance, we know that expressed in these variables and a little bit changed, it has a pole in the complex plane of the variable v, the simple pole. We know that. Now, this function is deformed by this parameter, nu. In principle, we know nothing about the deformation. But when you look at the expansion of the post-Newtonian coefficient, nu is just changing a little bit the numerical coefficient. So you hope that if a function had a simple pole in the complex plane before this deformation, its infinite series, after deformation, it will still have a simple pole, but somewhere else, the pole will navigate in the complex plane. So let's just assume it has a simple pole, and now we can use Padé approximants, because Padé approximants are tuned. When you know nothing about a function except that it is meromorphic in a complex plane, then everybody will tell you, Padé it. This will always, or not always, it will most of the time improve things. But even there are instabilities in Padé, so we are taking a bet. But anyway, we Padé it, and this gives this explicit rational function now. This object, we have tested to 11 post-Newtonian orders that Padé approximants converge very well. In fact, let me show you the thing. Because this, for me, is a good indication that what we do makes sense. This curve is the gravitational wave flux at infinity normalized to, let's say, the quadrupole formula. So it starts from 1 for when this variable v is small. V is plotted horizontally. The solid line, which is here put in blue, was obtained by a numerical calculation. This is for the test mass result. So this is the limit nu equals zero, where you can do perturbation theory to high order, and you can do numerical calculations, and you can compare them. To do that, if you compare the post-Newtonian usual results for this quantity, the usual expansion, at the best, which is known, which is 2.5 pn, you get something like that. Quite bad. I mean, in fact, not so bad, but it differs by 30 or 40% from the answer at the LSO, and it diverges from this. Now, if you use Padés, the Padés, they are here. And at the level we use, this Padé is here. So it is we know it is a little bit off in the test mass limit, but it is so much better than everything else. And when you use higher Padés, in fact, all the higher Padés are totally coincident with this line. So we have some evidence when the parameter nu is zero, that Padéing is very good, and Taylor expansions are very bad. We take this information and say, when nu is non-zero, Taylors which were bad cannot get better. I mean, that I would never trust. And therefore, we use Padé which were good, which might become bad, but that's our best bet. That's the logic. Okay?
Can I just ask the general global thing?
Yes.
The second part of the talk, please.
But I want to finish the talk. Yes. How much more time do we have, Matt? Okay.
No,
let's not exaggerate.
I'm not backtracking you.
Yeah, okay.
So, when you said that I want to map now, right, and like that, to do this resummation now, again, you're trying to find a new metric now?
Here, I'm just resumming an invariant function of an invariant variable. I have the gravitational wave flux as a function of this invariant variable v, gauge in coordinate invariant. This is given by 1 plus v squared plus v cubed. I know this series like that. When I compute its successive Taylor approximants, it does not converge well. I mean, I did not plot they go like that, they go like that. I know when I do rational function approximation of this function by Padé approximant, this tames the convergence, and now these things get very near what I know you made.
So I part of the talk,
this is finished.
Right.
Now, the second part is I say, this is what I said before. I needed to add radiation reaction. This was this F in the right-hand side. Now, one of the components of F is angular momentum loss. Now, for circular orbits, there is a one-to-one link between angular momentum loss and energy loss, because dE, the energy, is omega dj, the angular momentum. And therefore, resumming momentum loss or energy loss is the same thing. We had already resumed energy loss, so I use this formula. Now I use this formula to compute F phi. This is this formula. In fact, this is still the gravitational wave flux, but now here's the formula. F phi is minus 1 over omega this phi, this thing, and I inject this in the right-hand side of the equations of motion where I use the effective geometry for the conservative part of the dynamics.
So finally the statement is that there's a motion in a given space of space-time, but it's not heuristic motion,
no,
on the right-hand side.
Exactly. And now this is what we use. So we use this system, which has on the left-hand side the Hamiltonian square root of square roots, in this deformed Schwarzschild type of space-time, and the right-hand side I have this Padé resummation of angular momentum. And now this is an explicit ODE, which tells us what is the evolution of the radius and the angular motion and the angular frequency when I take into account radiation reaction, and therefore this system incorporates the existence of a large stable orbit, but it also incorporates the existence of radiation reaction computed as precisely as possible, and therefore we are going to be able to study the transition through the last stable orbit and the beginning of the plunge. So let me in fact show you how numerical results look. So this is in the equal mass case, and what you get, okay, you integrate now these ODEs, and you get indeed that for a long time they have like an adiabatic in spiral, but near the last stable orbit this becomes not very adiabatic, and you have this transition that we can describe in numerical details, and then you have the plunge. Now, what also is important for the consistency of the whole game is that we have plotted here what is, let's say, the kinetic energy in the circular motion. This is P phi square over R square. And then the kinetic energy as it appears in the Hamiltonian in the radial motion with its metric coefficient B. And this is this one. And you see that in the inspiral phase down to the last stable orbit, which is here, the radial kinetic energy, as expected, is really completely negligible. But even during the plunge, where the radial kinetic energy increases, because you have the radial plunge, you still have much more kinetic energy in the circular motion, and therefore, as the main assumption for all our techniques of resummation, apart that we believe that we had resummed post-Newtonian things, that we are taking into account quasi-circular motion, is still valid down from 6m. So, although for numerical people we are saying, essentially, we stop just after the transition near the LSO, but at the beginning of the plunge, in fact, we also continue down to 3m, and we, in this way we estimate, but more roughly, a waveform, a complete waveform. So this is just to show the first type of result. So what do we get from these things? We get two types of results. One of them is to give explicit numerical values as a function of the parameter nu of dynamical initial data. That is to say, the position and momenta of two black holes as described in an ADM, canonical type coordinate system, just after the transition through the last stable orbit and at the beginning of the plunge. And in fact, we decided to stop at the invariant point where the orbit, the phi frequency is equal to formally the last stable orbit frequency, gravitational wave frequency. But we have to stop somewhere. We could stop a little bit beyond. There is a freedom there. And then we compute Qs and Ps. For instance, we have explicit values of the coordinate distance in ADM and the radial momentum. So we have the two things are not like that. They have slightly radial momentum because the plunge has started. But most of the motion is in the transversal direction, so we give all these quantities. So these are dynamical initial data. What is lacking here, evidently, is that we don't have initial data for numerical relativity, which would be a first and a second fundamental form. I want now to work on that using post-Newtonian studies and non-perturbative resummation and evidently some form of matching as we had used many years ago. What I want to say, yes, that we could in fact, although here the idea was to give data only, let's say, around 6m and then to say numerical relativity will compute the rest of the plunge because we do not trust our resummation too far. I mean, although it is quite good at the LSO, somewhere between the LSO and probably 3M, okay, we do not trust it anymore. But still, as it seems from the thing that 3M is not so far from what we do, we do compute up to 3M, and we could give also initial data at 3M if we wanted. And therefore, these initial data could be used either for numerical calculation of the merger at 3M or for some type of closed limit approximation there that we do in a primitive way at the end, in fact. So there are different ways of using. But in all cases, there is the problem of transcribing our Q and P data in first and second fundamental form. That I do not claim at all to know to do to the accuracy we do that today. Now, the other part of the... yes, I should say also that a striking result is that we can give scaling laws. Like, for instance, in the small new limits, we prove that the radial momentum at the LSO varies like nu to the power 3/5. So it's an analytical prediction which is valid only for very small nu, but then this analytical prediction is valid up to the maximum value of nu. So, for instance, there are simple scaling laws. There is another scaling law for the number of orbits left after the last stable orbit, defined in some way, after crossing the last stable orbit, and this is given by this thing. And what happens, what is important here is that here is one, so it means below this line, there is less than one orbit to go, okay, and below this line means all values of nu between a tenth and the maximum value, so it means for practical purposes, all binary black holes of galactic origin. It does not apply to LISA, let's say. But you would have to go to very small mass ratio to have more than one orbit, you know, in the plunge. This is a non-trivial thing. The scaling here is nu to the minus 1/5. So it's such a small scaling of nu that for many nus, you have less than one orbit to go. So it is important. So the plunge is indeed fast, but still quasi-circular. And now we go all the way to estimate a waveform. That is to say, heuristically, we say, okay, so why stop at 6M? Let's go all the way. Nothing prevents us from doing that. But we try to inject physical information there, and we get this. So this, I think, will be useful for LIGO. This, I think, is the first time that one can see a semi-realistic estimate of the complete waveform, which includes a good description of the adiabatic in-spiral that was known before, a good description of when the in-spiral ceases to be adiabatic. I won't show here the differences with adiabatic. Adiabatic things get bad here. So the transition between adiabatic and the plunge is here, and we think that our method gives this crucial transition very accurately, and the beginning of the plunge and the plunge, because the plunge finally is this. The plunge is 0.6 orbits. In gravitational waves, it means twice as many cycles, so it gives 1.2 cycles, so you get one cycle from the plunge, and we compute this waveform by using approximate formulas which are not valid anymore, so because to compute the amplitude of the waveform and the frequency of the waveform, we use things which are rough here, but that should be indicative, and then we stop when the two things get at the in our deformed Schwarzschild metric, there is also a light ring, which is deformed from the 3M. We have no argument here for saying that the light ring here is the real light ring for wave propagation, because this effective metric is not a real metric for propagation of wave propagation, okay? But the light ring is very near 3M anyway, we stop around it, and then we say that at this level, the two things are so near each other that gravitational waves will be filtered out. So we replace the two bodies at 3M by one black hole, but this black hole now is a Kerr black hole because the two bodies are moving with relative momenta and therefore there is angular momentum in the system. And then we replace we match the rest of the wave to the least damp quasi-normal mode in a Kerr black hole with energy and angular momentum defined by our initial data at the light ring, and the first and second derivative of the waveform continues. Okay, that fixes completely the waveform. One could do better. One could impose more derivatives and then include more quasi-normal modes. But the good information, I think, I mean, I don't know if this is correct now, but if this is correct, what you see is that first, this merger and ring down signal that we knew is much more higher frequency than before. So for LIGO, for the critical mass I was talking about, it's not very important. And also, the amplitude decays very fast. We knew that, but it never goes up. Now, it's not like you have a big blurb of wave coming from the merger. Exactly, in a sense, this is assuming what we do. The big blurb comes from the plunge, and it's not very big. Anyway, if that were true, this is important for detection, and this can help very much in having templates which are very accurate and do not lose signal-to-noise ratio here. But now we want to study, to use this thing as a guesstimate to make more data analysis studies of what we know, what we don't know, what LIGO should inject as information. And I hope that within 2 years, numerical relativity can replace this guesstimate of the plunge thing and the rest by another guesstimate, which will be a numerical estimate. And if they agree, then we will be more confident. Okay, thank you.
During the plunge, the system loses a significant amount of angular momentum.
Yeah, not much. Fractionally, not much. No, it's like it's quite small.
Well, it loses a lot, right? Because of out of the orbit.
No, there is only 0.6 orbits.
Right.
Exactly.
So can you check if this waveform that you have there that doesn't seem to be radiating a lot of energy at that point is somehow radiating a lot of angular momentum?
No, but you are talking between during the plunge, it's here.
Right.
After this, you don't lose.
No, after that, it's fine. After that, you just lose.
Okay. So what we compute, we have an equation of motion which gives angular momentum loss with some, and we use it to integrate it during the plunge. So we take into account that the angular momentum at the LSO is lost down from 6m to 3m, let's say, to speak roughly, and therefore the angular momentum of the curl is smaller than that. But this effect is small. We could have used essentially the angular momentum at the LSO still include the plunge. We take this into account, but it's fractionally it's small. It is a little loss, which is in waves at infinity. This is radiating. What I'm saying is the amount of angular momentum, in fact, this is evident from this figure. The amount of angular momentum you are going to lose from this cycle is anyway less than what you have lost before, and it's not compared to all what you lost in one orbit.
Everything you lost before, but it's significant in a short amount of time it takes.
It is significant, we take it into account, but we are going to study whether, for instance, if we neglect it, just to have an idea of, maximum ignorance principle or whatever, saying let's do things in a way we know it is wrong to see what difference it would make. It won't make an enormous difference. It will be barely visible, in fact, on this figure. These things are radiating less than what you have been brainwashed to believe, I think. Yes. No, forget about this. This is. I should have said, I did not want to look too Frenchy, but I could have said in 1885, Delaunay invented a new approach to celestial mechanics, which is called Delaunay Hamiltonian, and we used that. But it looked more flashy for me to quote Bresin 6 and 0, which is really where I got the idea. But okay.
Okay. But what I'm wondering is
Yeah, but you can compute all Fourier diagrams in X-space. Okay, let me tell you, the diagrams I was showing, they have a one-to-one counterpart in classical diagrams that we use. That's why I was showing that. There is a one-to-one relation between Feynman diagrams and classical diagrams in post-Minkowski approximation to two-body interactions, which are all those lines I was drawing. And this is the way we computed things. So each line I was representing on the left is a way of representing, let's say, one term or a series of terms in a classical post-Newtonian expanded Hamiltonian. Now, these integrals, they can be computed either in X-space or P-space. And in fact, it's not useful to go to Fourier space up to now. Everything could be done in X-space. So we don't think. But what the main point is what you said at the end, that these techniques are expansions around zero field. And they are indeed the same as those post-Newtonian expansions where you assume like H equals GM over R is small in a sense. And you expand in this parameter, GM over R. And the problem is that at the LSO, compared to at the horizon, there is only a factor of 3. So we have something which is like 1/3 plus 1/3 square plus something like that. And this is, we start from a series of this type on the left, and we retranscribe it in a form which is apparently much better convergent.
So there is a nice class where we do the set of half the bus one, so there's
No, no, no. Yep. Ah, because the this is clear from this thing here. Go here. Okay. Okay. The light ring is okay. So, for instance, in the Newtonian approximation, this object would be what? This is like in ordinary quantum mechanics or classical dynamics. You have the potential minus 1 over r, which is gravitational attraction, and you have the repulsion due to angular momentum, which is plus LL plus 1 L squared over r squared. Now, in classical dynamics, L squared over r squared goes to infinity higher than minus 1 over r, so you have an infinite potential barrier here, and you always have a stable orbit here. Now, general relativity and our deformation we discussed here replaces this by a factor which goes to 0 here, and therefore the centrifugal barrier is shut down here. And therefore it means if you have a minimum here, you will have also a maximum here. And a maximal here is a possible circular orbit, but it is an unstable circular orbit. And therefore, you have not only the stable circular orbits, but you have also unstable circular orbits being nearer than the last stable circular orbit. And now if you ask what is the last stable, the last unstable, the innermost unstable circular orbit, you have to take the maximum of this thing as near as you can from here, and then you prove that because of the game between 1 minus 2m over r and j squared over r squared, this, you cannot go nearer than 3m. So the light ring is the last place where a material object can go around in an unstable orbit if you put it with infinite energy. And that's why if you put a massive particle, you have to give it infinite energy. Then if you give it infinite energy, it forgets that it was a massive object. The mass is negligible, so it becomes like a massless object. And this way you prove that necessarily there is a light ring at the last unstable orbit, and which has to be nearer than 6m, and you have to compute it that it is not as near as 2m. But smaller. Ah, yes, it is. Now, everything is shifted down. But the reason is now this minus 2m has a coefficient plus a correction there, and then it shifts down everything. Like gravity is a little bit more attractive in some sense, although it's not true. What I just said. Anyway.
I'm trying to understand the connection between the
no, I never gave you radii.
You were writing things in terms of the R. In fact, you saw some curves.
Yes. But the waveform, for instance, does not include any knowledge about the radius. The waveform is computed only from invariant quantities like the gravitational wave frequency. In fact, I should say that the waveform which is plotted is the so-called restricted waveform, where you express everything in terms of angular velocity, phi dot, which is an invariant quantity at infinity, and you know that to some approximation this mimics well. What is important is that the phasing of this thing is right, and the amplitude is quasi correct for a long time, and there are corrections to the amplitude but not to the phasing. So we use this restricting waveform and we don't use coordinates. And when we say that we give position and momenta at the last stable orbit, we define last stable orbit by some invariant characterization, saying for instance that the angular velocity, the circular velocity, is equal to what we computed in the first part, but we could give it 20% higher frequency than that because we do not need to stop anywhere in the plunge. I mean, yes, we specify it by saying we give initial data at the place where the angular frequency, the motion, the frequency of the angular motion is equal to what we computed in the first part as being the last stable orbit for conservative dynamics. But this is a convention. I could give for data 10% higher or 10% lower than this because the plunge never stops. We don't have to give. What is important is that there is anyway less than one orbit to go. And we don't want to. We stop the calculation for this part. We give data at a position where they are still separate enough, 6m, that we hope that some resummation technique will be able to give initial data for two black holes, okay? But sufficiently down in the orbit that we have gone through the transition, because the transition takes several orbits, okay? And therefore we want to be through the transition so that you have already a simple numerical calculation with less than one orbit. But there is freedom, flexibility here. That's why we say we can even go down to 3M, but there we don't believe.
I don't think there is actually an estimate for the amount of energy radiated inside the solar system. Is that correct?
It is contained there. We did not compute it per se. It is contained in the answer I gave to Jorge, which is that we compute the difference. It is in the paper in energy and angular momentum at the last stable orbit and at 3M, let's say. So this difference is due to what is radiated in between, because that's what we put in. But this difference is, I must check, but fractionally, it's, there is less, I mean, okay. I should say that the thing, finally, is like quasi, what is important. Okay, the amount of radiation in the last plunge is comparable to what was emitted before, let's say, I think. I have to check this because factors of two or three are important here. But what is important here is in the last three orbits, or here two orbits before the last stable orbit, the amount of radiation was still small. There is this famous quadrupole formula which says there is something which is V5, okay? I said before, we cannot trust post-Newtonian estimates of this, but now let's say we trust what we say, and the V5 becomes 1 over square root of 6 to the 5, and this is a small number which finally is like a 1/5, I forgot, but the number of cycles it takes for the frequency to change significantly at the last stable orbit is 5. That is to say, in one orbit, the frequency and the fractional energy lost has been only 1/5. In one orbit. Okay? So it is still small. It's not emitting much. And now, during the plunge, this 1/5 will go up because the velocities, you go nearer and velocities go somewhat higher, but it does not go to 200% or something like that. So there is something going on in the... Okay, this... Now we are trying to extract the physics of what we do more, okay? But anyway, we don't anticipate, finally, that something dramatic will happen and the plunge will emit twice more energy than everything which was emitted in all the orbits before, and that the merger will emit 10 times more. I should say that a lot has been made over the last years of some paper by Hughes and Flanagan, or the reverse order, I don't know, but they make absolutely ridiculous assumption in my mind about extremely high spinning orbits, that you emit 10% of the total mass energy during the plunge and merger and things like that, because they are stalled and things like that. This might be correct in a small corner of parameter space, but in my assumption, there is nothing behind these assumptions. And it seems to me that in the more tame system of two non-spinning black holes or fully spinning black holes, you will get something like that, which is not an enormous blur coming from the plunge, but still something for the phasing extremely important to know.
I think that because you calculated this thing essentially by estimates of the radiation or the angular momentum going out the first place,
yes,
you could in fact pull out of the kind of calculations you've already done a similar plot which simply shows the integrated energy as a fraction of the initial S mass that was left
at each point, yes. It is contained there, yeah, to understand better. Yes.
Yes.
Yeah, but let me, if I take your philosophy, which is that I can start to do things even now,
yeah, quasi-circular, but not quasi-adiabatic, because we are beyond adiabatic. It's definitely non-adiabatic.
The last orbit, which is close to them, I'm trying to estimate, you know, how much binding energy I have, and I want to get down to 3M, how much binding energy I have, and that's a big difference, if I can do this quasi-circular.
But quasi-circular means quasi-circular for some things, but still you convert potential energy in radial motion. So, but as you had a lot in circular motion, it is much less quasi-circular than before, because you have put this energy, not indeed, in a sense, the energy does not go in a flux at infinity, but is converted from circular motion to plunge motion. but not enough to make it completely plunge. You know, it's still quasi-secular. But I agree that this answer is not 100%. One has to look more of what is the balance of these various contributions to the energy between circular, radial, and emitted to have a clear answer to this question. Yes, Valerie? I think it would fit here.
I cannot tell the answer because I don't know his units. Well, our calculations say that less than 1% of the mass is needed at the end. And it would sound to me that that would have to be bigger than what he's getting. Because I don't know the units of the bus.
Do you mean the solid mass
here? In fact, I would like to discuss with you, because we had a problem of knowing when to stop our plunge calculation and when go to the one black hole thing, and it was difficult to extract from what exists in what has been done of to express at which point we should match. Okay, so finally we got from some calculation there that for the comparable mass case you were matching at something which was not very far from 3M, and as in our scheme we had the light ring where it looked like the natural way of stopping within. We stopped at our 3M, which was a little bit inwards from 3M, but here the match could have been here and there, and if it were here, the dotted line would be this one, so there would be more energy in the dotted line, but less in the plunge before. So probably things have to be studied, what difference it makes to match here and here. But the overall thing would not change too much.
The interesting thing would mean that if you did several calculations, you got the same curve independent of how much it was about.
Of how much, what assumptions one would change.
Yes. Change the matching point and find that you drew the same curve and just change how much of it were solid and how much were dashed.
What is the ratio of intensity there at the end?
In fact, it's quite high. You can see it here. There is a jump of, if I remember, between, for instance, the LSO frequency and this, 2.5. So suddenly out of LIGO frequency. For instance, I was saying at the beginning that LIGO thing sees, in fact, this part, and this part, it's really high frequency and down in the noise, maybe. And this transition, how the frequency jumps up, I mean, slowly during the adiabatic, in the plunge a little bit, but then it seems there's still a jump in frequency to go to the quasi-normal mode. And, okay, let me see them here. There is a lot left for numerical calculations to find out. Okay.
Any questions? I think we're here at 2 o'clock.